Welcome to Honey from the Rock, a podcast devoted to Bible exposition. My father, Jack Christensen, preached expositionally for over 50 years, first as a missionary to Pakistan and later as a pastor in New England. His legacy lives on in me. He often began his sermons with a little expression, and now a little honey from the rock, taken from Psalm 81, verse 16. The psalmist wrote, "I would feed you with the finest of the wheat, and with honey from the rock I would satisfy you." Today, more than ever, we need to feed our souls on the words of God in the Bible. The crying need of the church is for God-centered, word-explaining messages. So now, my friends, a little honey from the rock. Years ago, I visited one of the North African countries where speaking the name of Jesus in the wrong situations can get you arrested. The underground church worships in private, because public worship of Christ could be prosecuted as a crime. We had smuggled Bibles and other Christian literature into the country under the seats of our car and delivered them to Christians in a private home. We met a Christian couple at a campground to offload the literature they had smuggled into the country so we could take the materials to the distribution center. This particular couple vacationed each year in their recreational vehicle in the North African country. They smuggled Bibles and Christian resources in their camper, and we had the privilege of enjoying tea with them before they left the country. These Christians face economic and political persecution. The government periodically tests their loyalty to Christ through the lure of financial success. If you want to make money or have a successful career, pledge your allegiance to the country instead of the kingdom of Christ. What would it cost for us to sell out our faith, to trade the kingdom of Christ for financial prosperity? We in America do not live in a Christian nation. No Christian in any country in the world lives in a Christian nation. All nations are secular. That is why Peter, in 1 Peter, calls us aliens in a foreign land, no matter where we live, just like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in Babylon. This world is not our home. We are immigrants in a foreign land. Sooner or later, the pressures of life test our pledge of allegiance to Christ. We have to ask ourselves, is our faith for sale? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego faced that question in Daniel 3. We pick up the story in verse 8. The three young men had refused to worship the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up on the plain of Dura as a test of loyalty. They chose to serve God over the government. When the government becomes God, we must refuse to bow before the altar of government. Our pledge of allegiance is to a higher authority than any human government, any charismatic leader, or any political party. That is the cost of true faith. I would like to point out three principles regarding true faith in Daniel chapter 3, verses 8 through 18. Principle number one, true faith provokes opposition, verses 8 through 12. For this reason, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and brought charges against the Jews. They responded and said to Nebuchadnezzar the king, "O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, and bagpipe, and all kinds of music, is to fall down and worship the golden image. But whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the administration of the province of Babylon, namely Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have disregarded you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image which you have set up. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego must have known it was going to be a bad day when they looked across the thousands of government officials gathered on the plain of Dura and saw a group of Chaldean officials watching them carefully as the band started playing the music. They had to make a choice. Would they prostrate themselves on the ground in front of this image like everyone else? It would be easy to reason, we'll bow our knees, but not our hearts. Or, hey, everybody else is doing it. Or perhaps, after all, if we don't do this, then we'll limit our future ministry, which we could do so much with. By bowing down now, we will have more opportunity to serve the Lord later. Or perhaps we can just pretend to bow down so that we can get ahead in our careers and better serve the Lord. My friends, is our faith for sale? What does it take to buy us out? These three young men didn't compromise their faith, and the other government officials brought accusations against them before the king. Notice that they begin by identifying them as certain Jews whom you have appointed to high government positions. They are not us. They are foreigners, aliens. They don't belong here. And then comes the false accusation. These men, O king, have disregarded you. Well, that was not true. As far as we know, these three young men had done their jobs for the king very effectively. They were good employees. They served the king well. But they did have a higher loyalty. That higher loyalty is their crime, just as it has been for believers down through history. We can love and serve our country only to a point, because we belong to a higher kingdom. In the end, we must say with Peter in Acts 5:29, we must obey God rather than men. What was their crime? Their crime was disobedience to the king, disloyalty. We see that they were told to fall down and worship the golden image in verse 10. They refused to worship that image. They would not worship at the shrine of human government. Then the magistrates reported to the king in verse 12 that these men do not serve your gods or worship the golden image which you have set up. The words are in a form that is intensive in the Aramaic. This was not just a passive exercise, but they were to passionately worship the image and embrace the gods as an act of loyalty to the king. And if not, they were to pay the price of the fiery furnace. This was a loyalty test. Pledge allegiance to the king or die. Beware, my friends, whenever a political leader demands your absolute loyalty. Loyalty tests are dangerous because they come with promises of gain versus threats of loss. We can lose our positions or our jobs if we do not swear our loyalty to the leader or the boss. Christians must never, ever give absolute loyalty to any political party or national leader. We owe our absolute loyalty to one person and one person only, Jesus Christ. And we may face our fiery furnace someday. when we have to make a choice, what's your fiery furnace going to be? Now, before we continue, let me address the question of Daniel's absence from this story, because many people speculate about the matter. There are several possibilities to explain his absence while not impugning his integrity. Daniel was not hiding out. Daniel may have been absent from the city on government business at the time. He may not have been required to show his allegiance in this way and may have been busy working in his government post and not present in Dura. It is very plausible that Daniel was exempt from the order, along with other high-ranking officials in the inner circle of the king. We know that the office Daniel occupied was not specifically listed as one of the ones required to participate. Whatever the particular reason, Daniel was not involved in this little test of faith, but his three friends were. Count on opposition when you obey God over men. Someone will be watching you. Now, we don't know the details, but these men were watching and waiting for an opportunity to report the three believers to the king. True faith obeys God even when it is not politically expedient to obey God. True faith obeys God regardless of the consequences sometimes. And true faith provokes the opposition of those around us. They won't like it. Someone may turn you into the boss. You might be blackballed in society. You may not die in a literal fiery furnace, but you will pay a price to follow Christ. When I was in North Africa, we stayed at the home of one of the workers we'll call Sam. Sam introduced us to a young North African we'll call Salim, who was staying with us. Salim was perhaps 22 years of age, not unlike these young men in Daniel 3. He had come to Christ and been studying the Bible through correspondence for a few years when his parents found the Christian literature in his room and threw him out of the house. They disowned him. He couldn't get work. Nobody would hire him, and he became bitter. Some men, antagonistic to Christianity, found him. They gave him money, a job, and a car, and he was suddenly doing very well. Then they asked him to report his Christian contacts. Ah, the test came. So, because he was doing well financially, he reported the worker I've called Sam to the authorities. These men threatened Sam. They blackmailed him to give them money for not reporting him. Sam refused and said, "I'll take my chances. Government officials know why I'm here." And they backed off. And eventually Salim repented, left the group, and came back to the Lord. On the day we visited, Salim had traveled across the country to apologize to Sam for what he had done to him. They were united once again in the Lord. It's a story with a happy ending, but you can easily see how the pressures of government loyalty can erode our faith in Christ. What's your fiery furnace? That leads us to the second faith principle. True faith trusts God's invisible power over man's visible power, trusts God's invisible power over man's visible power. Verses 13 to 15 of Daniel 3. Then Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and anger, gave orders to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Then these men were brought before the king. Nebuchadnezzar responded and said to them, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up?" Now, if you are ready at the moment you hear the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, and bagpipe, and all kinds of music, to fall down and worship the image that I have made, very well. But if you do not worship, you will immediately be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. And what God is there who can deliver you out of my hands? Nebuchadnezzar was an idol worshiper. Nationalism and nationalistic pride were bound up in his idolatry. He, as king, represented the gods who made Babylonian history possible. Nebuchadnezzar had dedicated the massive and spectacular Ishtar Gate, and just outside the Ishtar Gate was the Temple of Akitu. Every year in the spring, they celebrated a great festival of renewal. The past was eliminated at the end of winter, and the spring symbolically was the start of new life. Their fate as a nation was determined by pleasing the gods in the spring festival. Otherwise, the nation would fall. So the nation gathered outside the Ishtar Gate to worship the gods so their nation would be renewed. The god Nabu, who was the god of wisdom and writing, would be brought from the temple in Borsippa to the temple of Akitu. A great festival took place, which included the reading of the famous Enuma Elish, which described the war of the gods that resulted in the creation of the universe. The climax of the festival, very interestingly, took place when the priests would slap and beat King Nebuchadnezzar until the tears flowed from the pain. This symbolic beating, which was more than symbolism, of course, was to prove that he was the servant of the gods and that the nation's existence depended on him pleasing those gods. Otherwise, the nation would be destroyed. So, in the king's eyes, worshiping the image was essential to the future of the nation. It was tied up in his nationalism. It was vital lest the gods destroy him and his kingdom. Religious nationalism is a powerful and dangerous force in any society. Nebuchadnezzar's authority as the representative of the gods led to his rage when his decree was rejected. The impressive temples and city, in fact, their whole history was at stake in his mind. Their gods were visible and powerful, and nobody should dare thumb their nose at them. And that is precisely why religious nationalism is so dangerous. In religious nationalism, you must worship the gods of our country, or the nation will cease to exist. The zeal to enforce religious nationalism becomes overwhelmingly powerful. But my friends, we worship a God we cannot see. We see God by faith, because our God is invisible. We look around at the wealth and the power of humans in this world. We can see the power of those around us, the wealth of corporations and countries, and we can become frustrated that such power is used against God. Human power is visible, it's obvious, but God's power is often invisible. But my friends, we are better off trusting the invisible power of God over the visible power of men. King Nebuchadnezzar issues another challenge. He gives the three men another chance, a second chance. He even is willing to set up the orchestra for a private worship session for these three men. All they had to do was bow down and live. The penalty for disobedience was death. Notice the challenge that the king issues in verse 15. What God is there who can deliver you out of my hands? What God can deliver you from my hands? Now we see clearly what this is all about. Nebuchadnezzar is usurping the place of God. My hands are more powerful than your God, he is saying. Yet sometime earlier, he had bowed before their God. In Daniel 2:46-47, we read, "Then King Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face and did homage to Daniel and gave orders to present to him an offering and fragrant incense. The king answered Daniel and said, 'Surely your God is a God of gods and Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, since you have been able to reveal this mystery.'" But now he claims authority over Daniel's God. "I am king and deserve your complete allegiance. You will honor me with all you do. I have the power to make you successful or to destroy you. Your God can do nothing for you, so you had better trust in me and my gods, for I have the power." There's a very real pressure to trust more in the powers that we can see than in the powers we cannot see. After all, God can't give you an A in that course. Your grade is in the professor's hands. Your promotion at work depends on the boss, not on God. Our freedom to practice our faith depends on the government and the president and who gets elected, not on God. Or does it? Are those statements true? The answer is no. They are not true. Our success, our following of God, our approach to life does not depend on government or corporations or money or power. Such challenges are the same challenges that these young men faced. Is our faith for sale on the altar of human success? Or will we be willing to trust the invisible power of God even if we must pay the price of our loyalty? John Lennox, professor of mathematics at the University of Oxford and a fine Christian apologist, tells the story of his early experience as a scientist, which forced him to make a choice. Would he trust the invisible God or the visible powers of his world? He was a young student who found himself seated at dinner next to a Nobel laureate. He tried to engage him in conversation about his faith in God with limited success. After dinner, the famous scientist invited John Lennox and some of the man's colleagues to his room for coffee. Lennox was the only young student among the group of esteemed professors. The Nobel laureate professor asked John Lennox, after they were seated comfortably, if he would like to pursue a career in science. "You want to be successful scientifically?" And Lennox replied, "Well, yeah, yes, sir." "Then give up these childish ideas of God. They will only disadvantage you intellectually among your peers," the man said. Lennox tried to defend his faith in God, but then he was quickly dismissed. The message was abundantly clear. Give up your faith to have success in your scientific career. Will we worship the gods of this world and so achieve success in our careers? Or will we stand up for the one true God and risk success in this life? True faith trust God's invisible power over man's visible power, even if there is no apparent success in this life. Third principle, true faith preaches without presumption. Preaches without presumption, verses 16 to 18. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to give you an answer concerning this matter. If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But even if he does not, let it be known to you, O king, that we are not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. Steve's daughter was undergoing treatment at the medical center for anorexia and bulimia. One particularly difficult day, she was told to drink a glass of milk, but she just couldn't make herself do it. Her doctor was called in. He sat down beside her on the bed and said, You are a Christian, correct? She answered that she was a Christian. Her doctor said, Do you remember the man Jesus healed near the pool of Siloam? Jesus put mud on his eyes to bring about healing. But what really healed him? She thought for a moment and then said, God, his faith in God. Good, the doctor said. Now drink your mud. The response of these three young Hebrews is classic. So often we want God to fix our problem, to perform a miracle, to heal our disease, to change whatever challenges we face. And God can, and God does work miracles. And we expect God to work miracles for us, so much so that we can become presumptuous in our faith. We can refuse to drink the mud. True faith is not presumptuous. True faith does not assume that God will miraculously save us from the fire. These three Hebrews tell the king that God could save them from the fiery furnace, but even if he does not save them, they will still follow God. They do not trust in God only if he does what they want him to do, if he helps them out of the predicament. Their faith is not based on God's answer. Their faith is founded in God's character. American Christianity tends to become a commercialized faith. It has often been described as a consumer Christianity. We follow God as long as we don't get hurt, and as long as God meets our expectations. We proclaim that God will fulfill our dreams. We put ourselves in a position where we expect God to do a miracle, and when he doesn't fix our problem, then we become angry with God. That, my friends, is not faith. That is presumption. Pastor Ray Stedman puts it this way. Some people think the prayer of faith is crawling out on a limb and then begging God to keep someone from sawing it off. But that is not real prayer. That is presumption. If God makes it clear that he wants you out on the limb, fine, you will be perfectly safe there. If not, it is presumptuous to crawl out on that limb expecting God to keep you there. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego demonstrate a healthy, balanced faith in God. They are quiet, respectful, and polite. They do not rant and rave at the king. They do not play the victim card. They do not whine and complain about their situation. They do not blame God or Daniel or anyone else for what has happened. They did not seek persecution through protest, and neither did they avoid it by hiding their faith. They do not preach a false message. It's sad when Christians make some grandiose promise that God will heal your disease or provide you with a new car. Sometimes people say that if you have enough faith, then God will make you better. He will heal you. Well, that's a lie. Real faith does not presume God's answer. God can heal you. God may or may not heal you. I cannot promise you that God will fix your problem or save your business. Such promises are presumptuous, and I'm always grieved to hear preachers who make sickness into some sort of faith failure on the part of a believer. Listen to what these young men said. If it be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But, even if he does not, let it be known to you, O king, that we are not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. They were courageous in their faith. They knew God could save them, but submitted to God's wisdom, God's will, to know whether he should save them. Whether God heals you or not, true faith believes in God and trusts that God always does all things well. Whether God makes you successful in business or not, true faith believes that God is good all the time. Whether you get your laws passed in government and you have a place at the power table or not, true faith believes that God is good all the time. This is one of the most fundamental lessons of the Christian life. Yet we must never stop confessing the power of God before a world that laughs at our impotence. We confess God's power not by making outlandish claims and crazy promises that only make Christianity look foolish when God doesn't do what he said he would do. We confess God's power when we choose to follow God's ways no matter what the consequences. We confess God's power when we choose to obey God even if we pay the price for that obedience. We demonstrate true faith when we act against our own self-interest. Why? Why? Because we know, as Warren Wiersbe writes, that times of adversity are usually times of opportunity. Look at verse 16. O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to give you an answer concerning this matter. We don't have to justify ourselves or defend our God. We don't have to carefully prove God's power to this world or explain his ways to people. Our job is to obey God and stand firm when called upon to give an answer. But God is capable of defending himself. He asks us to speak the truth. God asks us to be willing to confess his holy name no matter what the consequences might be. Confess! 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 The words rang out in the sanctuary of Trinity Lutheran Church in Berlin. A young pastor was urgently, passionately challenging the Christians to wake up and confess Christ during the early years of Nazi Germany, when pressure was upon the church to abdicate their Christian faith and put their faith in Hitler. This young pastor went on to say, "The church will not be taken from us. Come, you who have been left alone, you who have lost the church, let us return to Holy Writ. Let us go forth and seek the church together. For the times which are a time of collapse to the human understanding may well be for her a great time of building. Church, remain a church. Confess, confess, confess." Is our faith for sale? On Thursday, March 7, 2024, Sergeant Corbin Schultz was arrested at Fort Campbell, straddling the Tennessee and Kentucky border. Sergeant Schultz was a 24-year-old intelligence analyst for the Army. He is accused of selling top-secret documents about high-mobility artillery rocket systems, hypersonic equipment, and studies on military operations in countries like China. Sergeant Schultz was paid a total of $42,000 for the information. But it didn't start out that way. He was first approached by a person identified as Conspirator A, who said he was from Hong Kong. The person asked for documents explaining what the United States had learned from Russia's war with Ukraine. And he was paid $200 for those documents. But once he had compromised his allegiance to his country for $200, then he was recruited to enter into a quote-unquote long-term relationship. You see, compromise starts small and grows big. This young soldier was willing to sell out his country for $200. A little bit of leverage eventually leads to greater compromise. So it is with our faith, my friends. Compromise starts small. We cut a few corners just once in a while. We look the other way when the boss wants to skim a little bit. We fudge our integrity to get ahead. It's just a minor thing. But then comes the bigger challenge, and a bigger one. Will we compromise Christ's kingdom for a piece of political power? Will we stay silent when we should speak up? What would it take for you to sell out what you believe? Does success matter that much that we would sell out God to be successful in our careers? My friends, we must not be afraid to stand for Christ in our culture, in our schools, in our politics, in our friendships, in our workplaces. Will we refuse to compromise our faith? Freedom to speak is a precious gift that may atrophy through apathy.